We're on Kuf Nun Ches Amid Beis, four lines up from the bottom, the third word on the line where it says, Shalchu Mitam. The Gemara presents a teaching that will eventually be related back to our Mishnah. The first big question is what the teaching actually said. Shalchu Mitam, they sent from there, meaning from Eretz Yisrael, the following halacha. This is the language of the teaching as the Gemara initially understands it, that the halacha is Ben Shalava Bin Nichse Aviv. Bechaye Aviv, if a son, let's say his name's Reuven, borrowed money against his father's properties, like he mortgaged his father's estate that eventually he'll inherit, and he said, okay, lend me this money, and you'll have a lien on my father's properties. Umeis, and subsequently, Reuven's father, Yaakov, died. They sent from Eretz Yisrael that the halacha is, Beno motzi miyad halakuchos. The son who borrowed money can seize properties from purchasers. The Gemara will immediately question what this means, but the teaching from Eretz Yisrael was then followed by an acknowledgement that this halacha is very difficult to understand. Vizuhi shekasha bedine mamonos. Though this is the halacha, it's a halacha that's very hard to understand. It's a monetary law that's very difficult to understand. So meaning that even though there's a legitimate question you could ask on this in logic, nevertheless, this is the halacha. But the Gemara points out that the halacha here seems incomprehensible. What does that mean, that Reuven borrowed money, now he could take land away from purchasers? The Gemara says, why would that be? Lava, if the son borrowed money, my mapik, why would that somehow give him the right to take away properties that his father had sold? Yod, and furthermore, the Gemara says, Lekuchos mayavidite. How did these purchasers become relevant at all to the story? All that happened here was the son borrowed money against the father's properties. It didn't mention that the father even sold the properties. So it's not clear why the purchasers are part of the story whatsoever. So the Gemara says it must be, this was a corrupted report of the ruling of the Shalchu Mitam they sent from Eretz Yisrael. And Ella I Itmar, Hachi, continuing to Kuf Nun Tes Itmar. If there was a ruling from Eretz Yisrael, which was followed by this declaration that Zuhi Kasha Bedine Mamonos, this is something that's hard to understand, there's a question on it in logic, but that's the way it is, this still is the halacha, this must have been the actual ruling that they sent from Eretz Yisrael. The following halacha. If Ben Shemachar Benichse Aviv Bechaye Aviv, the case is that this son, let's say we'll call him Reuven again, sold some of his father's properties while his father was alive. So his father at that point still owned the properties, but the son agreed with some lokech, he sold this person or these people the properties that he stood to inherit. He said, I'm going to be inheriting these properties, I'm selling the properties to you. But Umeis, son died. He died before the father. And eventually, at some point later, the father died. So first Reuven died, then Yaakov died. They sent from Eretz Yisrael that the halacha is, Beno, the son of the son, Reuven's son, so let's call him Chanoch, since he now is the heir of these properties, because of course he inherits his father who had the right to inherit his father, so he inherits Yaakov's properties, and therefore Motzi miyad alekuchos. Chanoch takes the properties away from the purchasers. They can't claim the properties based on Reuven's sale of the properties to them. Now, so far this seems very elementary, for given that Reuven died before Yaakov, Reuven's sale of the land seemingly ended up being meaningless. Reuven never came into possession of the properties. He died before his father. However, Tosus brings the Rivam, who explains that the Shalchu Mitam ruling is saying the purchasers are not awarded the properties and they're not even compensated. Even though Reuven had sold the properties he was expecting to receive to them with a guarantee. It was sold by Achrayus, which normally means that if something happens and they don't receive the properties, then they are compensated. They get their money back. But the ruling of the Shalchu Mitam is that in this case, Chanoch is under no obligation to even give them compensation. And the ruling is followed by the observation that Vizuhi Shekasha Bedine Mamonos. This is a ruling that's very difficult to understand in the area of monetary law. And the Gemara explains the difficulty is, at Vilayim Rulei, seemingly the purchaser should have the right to say to this Chanoch, what do you mean? that we're left high and dry, we're left with nothing, and we're not even compensated. Avuch mazvin va'at mapik. Your father, Reuven, sold us this property with a guarantee. And now you're simply taking the properties away from us with zero compensation. Seemingly, that doesn't make any sense. However, the Gemara questions the question. The Gemara asks, Umay Kusha, what's the difficulty here? Why is that a problem? Why is that a fair argument that your father sold and you're taking away from us? The Gemara now argues on Chanoch's behalf, Dilma Matziyamar, perhaps the grandson, this Chanoch, can simply reply to the purchasers, this agreement that you entered with my father is not my problem, for my right to inherit this property has nothing to do with my father, for I am not inheriting the property from my father. My father died before my grandfather. Rather, Mikoach Avua de Abba Kasina. I'm inheriting directly from my grandfather, from Yaakov. So yes, my father had some arrangement with you and he made some guarantee, but the property at the time simply wasn't his to sell. And the point is, even when my grandfather died, the property still had no connection whatsoever with my father. Because once he died before my grandfather, when my grandfather died, it was bequeathed directly from my grandfather to myself. And the Gemara proves that this is the way it works. That, you know, in this situation, the grandson takes the place of the father and inherits directly from his grandfather. Teda, you should know that this is true. We can prove this, Tichsiv, as it says in Tehillim, Kapitel Mem Hei. Tehillim says, Tachas avosecha yiyu vanecha. In place of your fathers shall be your sons. Tishisema lesarim achalaretz are going to be sarim, important officials throughout the land. So the Pasikin said, idea of b'nei banim kibanim, place of your fathers, so you is talking to the second generation, place of your fathers shall be your sons, the third generation. In other words, we can speak about grandsons as if they are sons, as if they're sons of the grandfather. B'nei banim, grandsons kibanim, are halachically like sons. So based on this, once again, the lakuchas have no argument at all. There's no basis for them to demand any compensation for Chanoch. Chanoch says, what does that have to do with me? I'm not inheriting this from my father Reuven, but rather from my grandfather Yaakov. And therefore, there appears to be no legitimate question here. It doesn't make sense, seemingly, that if this was the ruling, that it was followed by this declaration that this is Kasha B'dinei Maminus. What's the big Kasha B'dinei Maminus? It makes perfect sense that the purchasers get nothing. They lose the purchase. The Gemara therefore proposes that maybe the teaching really taught something else, a different halacha, and then we'll understand the follow-up question, the statement that, oh, this is hard to understand. Ela ikasha hakasha. If there was, again, a teaching from Shalcha Mitam, which was followed by a question, and this apparently was the teaching. Teaching was ben bachar shemachar chelek bachara b'chaye aviv. They taught specifically regarding a firstborn. So we use the same names. That works out. Reuven will be the firstborn. So we have Yaakov's firstborn, Reuven. And Reuven, once again, he goes ahead and sells the portion that's, he assumes is coming to him. Assuming his father dies first, he sells his firstborn double portion while his father is still alive. But in the end, again, Reuven dies before his father, Yaakov. The halach is, b'no motzi miyad alekuchos. Chanoch simply inherits the properties once Yaakov eventually dies. He has every right to take the properties away from the lekuchos and need not compensate them whatsoever. V'zuhi shekasha b'dinei mamanes. And this is a halach in monetary law that's hard to understand. For why did the purchasers end up with nothing? They're not even compensated. Avua mazvenu mapik. Given that the father, Reuven, had sold the properties fair and square to the purchasers, is it fair, does it make sense that the grandson Chanoch simply take the properties away from them and they're left with nothing? What happens to the agreement between them, the purchasers, and Reuven? Why is that now disregarded? And the Gemara explains, if this was the ruling of the Shalcha Mitam, now we can understand why there's a legitimate question here and why it's fair to say that this is Kasha B'dinei Mamanus. This is a halacha that's hard to understand. But the Gemara points out, V'chi Tem, if you're going to try and say that Hachan Nami, here's well, you'll say, what's the big deal? Of course the purchasers get nothing for Omar Mikoch Avua Daba Kasina, because Chanoch can say to them, I'm sorry for your bad luck, but my right to this property has nothing to do with my father. I'm inheriting it directly from my grandfather. The Gemara says, seemingly, that argument doesn't work in this case for Imikoach Avua Daba Kaasya. If that were really true, If Chanoch was really directly inheriting from the grandfather, Bechelek Bechora Mayavidite, then seemingly, how does it make any sense that Chanoch gets to keep the portion of the property that's included in the double portion, the second portion that his father, as firstborn, was entitled to? That is, Reuven is the firstborn, had a special right here to inherit his second portion. So seemingly, if Chanoch really makes the claim that he is directly inheriting from his grandfather, then how does Chanoch explain how he's getting a double portion? Seemingly, the only valid explanation is that it's really a two-step process. At first, we view it that Reuven inherits his father Yaakov in the grave. Reuven, of course, died before Yaakov, but in the grave, he legally inherits the property. And as firstborn, he gets a double portion of the property over all of the other brothers. And then that property, that double portion, is passed on to Chanoch. So now we understand the purchaser's argument. The purchasers say, what are you talking about? You can't say you're directly inheriting from your grandfather. No. Your father inherited it from your grandfather in the grave, and then you inherited it from your father. And since your father made up with us, he guaranteed to sell us this property, you should at least have to compensate us. You can't simply seize the property away without compensation. So now we seem to have a workable version of this ruling of the Shalchu Mitam. However, the Gemara now rejects this version as well. For the Gemara points out that Umay Kusha, still, why is there any difficulty with the ruling of the Shalchu Mitam? Dilma Matzi Amar. Still, why can't Chanoch, this grandson, say back to these purchasers that you have no claim here, you have no right to compensation? For really, Mikoach Avud Abba Kasina, I'm not inheriting the property from my father, but rather directly from my grandfather. If that's so, why do I get a double portion? Obviously, that's from my father. Chanoch says, you know why I get the second portion? Because I'm inheriting it from my grandfather, U bimakom av ka'imna, standing in the place of my father. It's like as if I'm Reuven, I'm in place of my father, as opposed to saying my father inherits the property in the grave and then bequeaths it to me in a two-step process. No, it's a one-step process. But the way that works is, I'm inheriting the property from my grandfather in place of my father. So on the one hand, I get a second portion because like it's as if I'm Reuven. On the other hand, since the property is not seen to actually be passing through the possession of my father Reuven, any agreement that my father Reuven made with you is of no concern to me. It does not create any kind of lien on the property. Because being that Reuven never had any kind of possession of the property, in retrospect, therefore, Reuven's sale of the property was completely meaningless, and therefore, I simply take the property from you, and I don't have to give you a dime. Therefore, the Gemara tries a different approach. The Gemara says, Ela ikasha ha-kasha. If there was a ruling of the Shalchu Mitam that there is a legitimate kasha on, you could say, oh, this is a difficult ruling. This must have been the ruling. Let's say a person signed on a shtar, he signed on a document that records some transaction, maybe a loan or whatever the transaction is. And of course, that document serves then as testimony that that event occurred. And in the case of a loan, for example, once the signatures of the document are verified, that gives the lender the right to take the document and seize properties even from purchasers who had purchased property from the borrower subsequent to the loan. The case deals with where one of the witnesses who signed eventually became a gazlan. It was established that he committed an act of theft, which renders him, classifies him as a gazlan, who is disqualified from testifying. But the date of the document predates the event of this person becoming a gazlan. But not a gazlan, sometime after the date in the shtar, this person became a gazlan. He went and robbed a bank. So now, from now on, of course, he's disqualified from testifying. But what about this document, this loan document, let's say, that he had signed on previously? The Gemara says, "Hu eino meyed al ksav yado." Mr. Gazlan cannot verify his own signature, even though normally the halacha is. And the very witnesses who signed could simply come into court and say, yes, these are our signatures, and that would normally be enough to verify the document. But this person is a Gazlan, he's disqualified from testifying, so we can't accept his testimony if he says, this is my signature. We can't trust him, he's a Gazlan. Avol acherim me'iden. But if you get other people from the shuk, you get other people from the public who can verify the signatures, then we'll accept that. And we can verify the shtar that way. So again, you're talking about a loan document that we're certifying, even though one of the witnesses who signed is known to now be a Goslin, but halacha is, since his becoming a Goslin occurred after the date in the shtar, it's fine. We say, okay, at the time he signed, he was a valid witness, and therefore the document is certified, and the lender can go and seize properties with this document. Gemara now explains that it was in reference to this ruling that it was declared Vizui Kasha Bedine Mamnas is a very hard monetary law to understand. Why? Because Hashta Ihu Lo Mehemin, once you've said that this witness himself is not believed to verify his own signature because he's a Goslin, Achrini Mehemni, other people should be believed to verify this one's signature. Saying if two other people come in and say, yep, it's his signature, that everything is hunky-dory, we assume this loan document is fine. That is very difficult to understand, because once we know we're dealing with a signature that belongs to a Goslin, and who knows what happened here? For all we know, this document is a complete forgery, and the date is completely false. Really, the date was after he became a Goslin. He forged it, he made it before he became a Goslin in order so that the court would verify this false document. And so it's fair to say that this is a very difficult monetary law. But the Gemara again comes back and says, my Kusha, what's the big deal? What's the difficulty here? Dilma kigon shehuchzak sav yado bebezdin. Maybe the ruling is referring to a situation where these other people who come in to verify the document are not directly verifying the witness's signatures, but rather they're verifying the verification. That is, that we're talking about a case where a henpik, the court's approval, their statement that this document has been verified, that was already written, inscribed in the document. So apparently the court already did their due research, they looked into it, and the signatures were fine. And again, the date of the shtar is before this witness became a Goslin. Now, the only thing that needs to be taken care of, like let's say we're in a different court, so now we need to just verify that the three signatures in which they're affixing a henpik, the court certification of the document, they're just verifying that those indeed are the signatures of three judges of a different court. So maybe that's all it means. And then it's perfectly understandable that in spite of the fact that, you know, now one of the witnesses who signed is a Goslin, that's no problem, because the date in this document is previous to this person becoming a Goslin. So once we ascertain that it's a valid henpik, that indeed in a different court they certify the document, then the document is A-okay. And so again, the Gemara says, if this was the teaching, we'd understand why it would say then that, oh, it's very difficult to understand. What's the difficulty? Therefore, the Gemara suggests a different approach. Ela'ikasha ha'kasha. We can suggest that the question was raised on the following ruling sent from the Chacham in Eretz Yisrael. They ruled ha'yoyodeh lo edus b'shtar ad shelo tipa lo b'yerusha. Again, we have a case where somebody signed on a document concerning some property, and at the time he signed, he had no personal connection to the property. It had not fallen to him in inheritance, nor was he expecting that it would fall to him as inheritance. But then, lo and behold, the situation developed such that he inherited the property, so that now he has a vested interest in the case. Now the property is relevant to him, which makes him no geb edus. He is connected, he has a personal interest in the case, so he cannot testify in such a case. And so the question is in terms of how we verify this document, how we verify the signatures. The halacha is, who einu yachol lekayim ksav yado? We cannot verify his signature based on his own testimony that it's his signature, because he's no ge be'edus, he's connected to the case. Aval acherim yicholim lekayim ksav yado. Others can come in and verify that indeed this is his signature, and the document will then be certified. So the Gemara suggests that it was this ruling that is, the kasha b'dini mamnas, it's very hard to understand this monetary law, for the same reason as in the previous case, that if there's a problem here that we can't really trust one of the witnesses who signed, he has a personal interest in the case, since so what if according to the date in the document, he didn't have a vested interest at the time? Once you're worried that somebody is going to lie, going to do a fabrication, how then can we be sure that this whole thing isn't a forgery, that he purposely recorded a date that was previous to his becoming connected with the case, so that it would be upheld in court? So even if others verify the signature itself, that the signature is indeed his signature, how can we trust the document. So it's kasha b'din imaminus, it's a hard law to understand the laws of monetary law. But again, the Gemara says, "Am I kosher? What's the problem? What's the difficulty?" The Gemara again suggests that it's no problem. For we could say that it doesn't mean that, you know, we could have two other people from the street verify his signature and then everything's okay. Now, maybe that's a problem. Rather, it's referring to where there's already a henpeck. There's already a written certification on the document, and the only issue now is to verify the certification. And we're saying, as long as those certification signatures are verified, then it's fine, because at the time that this document was evidently written, the person did not have a vested interest, and therefore the document will be verified. So it still doesn't fit. So Gemara instead suggests, okay, maybe this was the ruling, that they sent from Eretz Yisrael a ruling that Hayayodealo be'edos atshalonase chasano. Let's say somebody signed on a document about some monetary transaction, and at the time, this witness was not son-in-law of the subject in the case of the transaction, v'nasa chasana. Subsequently, one of the witnesses became the son-in-law of the subject in this document. And the halacha is, a son-in-law cannot testify for father-in-law, he's related. A karav is disqualified from testifying. If he's related to the subject, he can't testify. Halacha is, as far as validating this document, hu eina made aksav yado, the now son-in-law cannot verify his own signature because now he is, you know, disqualified as far as this case goes. Aval acher meidin. If others can verify his signature, then it's fine, because at the time this person signed, he was not related to any of the parties of the transaction. So perhaps it was this case where we asked the question that seemingly it's very difficult to understand, for hu lo mehem and achrini mehemni, that once again, if you're saying we can't trust his testimony because he's related to one of the parties of the transaction, then why should it help even if somebody else, two other witnesses, verify this person's signature, if the fact is we're not trusting this person who signed with respect to this case? And even though, according to the date of the document, the transaction occurred before he became disqualified with respect to this case, however, once we don't trust him, you know, who knows what happened here? Perhaps he went ahead and falsified the whole thing, including the date. Now the Gemara says, Vechitem, if you're going to say, once again, in this case, that Hachanami here as well, that no, it's not a problem for Kigon, Shehuchzik, Sav, Yado, Bibezdin, that really it means only that if there's already a written certification on the document, then once those signatures are verified, once we see that apparently some court already certified the document, then it's fine. If you'll try to knock off the question that way, as we did in the two previous proposals, the Gemara says, not here. For Veha Amar Rav Yosef Bar Min Yumi Amar Rav Nachman, explained that this halacha is saying, Af Al Pi Shelo Huchzik Sav Yado Bebezdin. We're not merely saying that if this document already had a court certification, we just need to certify that certification. No, we're saying more than that. We're saying, even if the document has no certification yet at all, if two others off the street come in and verify this one's signature, even though he is currently, now he's become the son-in-law of one of the parties in the transaction, nevertheless, that's fine. Once the signature is verified, we say the date on the document says he was not a son-in-law at the time, and therefore it's no problem. So now, seemingly, we have the answer. We have a working case, because in this case, you can legitimately ask that the hula mehem and achrini mehemni, that once again, if in the final analysis we don't trust the witness who signed it because presently he is a son-in-law, so what that the shtar says he was not a son-in-law at the time? Maybe that detail itself is false. It was fabricated by this witness that we can't trust. But the Gemara responds, the Gemara says, and still, that's not a fair question. But the Gemara says, my kusha, what's the problem? That's not a question, because the answer is, it's actually quite understandable why if two other people come in and verify this one signature, then it's fine. For Dilma, Gzeres Melechi, perhaps the nature of this particular halacha that says a relative like a son-in-law cannot testify in the case is not based on an obvious, you know, straightforward, rational reason, like in the case, let's say, of a gazet. If somebody's a bank robber, then it's very logical, it's pretty straightforward why we can't accept his testimony. We simply don't trust him. We suspect that he might lie. However, when it comes to this particular halacha, that if the witness is related to any of the parties that he's disqualified, he can't testify, perhaps fundamentally, this isn't really a straightforward, rational halacha. It's a gzeres melech. It's a decree of the king of God. Hashem said a relative can't testify. Not because there's any substantial suspicion that he's going to lie. Now, if that's the nature of this halacha, well, then it naturally follows. The iulo mehemen ve'achrini mehemni. Of course, if others verify the signature, then everything is okay. V'lav mishum the mishakir, because the reason in general, again, we're suggesting that a relative can't testify is not really because we really think he is lying here. Rather, it's a technicality. So, because of the technicality, it means we can't actually accept the relative's testimony to verify his own signature because he's related to one of the parties in the case. But being that we don't really think that he's going to give false testimony here, therefore, once other people in the street can verify the signature, we say, well, since according to the date in the document, it was not related at the time, therefore it's no problem. And Halacha doesn't say that we should be further concerned that maybe he fabricated the whole thing, the whole shtar. The Gemara now says this must be the nature of this particular halacha, that a relative can't testify. The Gemara argues the ilote mahachi, if you don't say that the halacha that a relative cannot testify is really more exeris melech, it's a divine decree, it's a decree of Hashem. If you say rather that no, it's a straightforward halacha that says we think this person is like a high likelihood he's going to lie. And the Gemara rhetorically asks, Moshe v'Aaron l'chosna mishum d'lo mehemni hu. Would you suggest that Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen, that they too would not be allowed to testify about their fathers-in-law? Would you say it's because the Torah is saying that they're not believed, they're not trusted, you can't trust Moshe and Aaron? Obviously that's ridiculous. So what do we have to say? Alexeris melechu shelo yaidu lohem. Obviously, the understanding in that situation is that, yes, even Moshe and Aaron wouldn't be allowed to testify on their relatives, because that's what Hashem said, it's a decree of the king. So the Gemara concludes, Hachanami here as well. This point applies, and we say, that yes, there's a technicality that since we tell this person, you know, you're related now. So therefore, we can't accept your testimony, it impacts this case. It's going to verify the document that talks about a person you're now related to, so we can't have you verify your signature, but if others verify the signature, then no problem, because it's simply verifying a document which is talking about an event that occurred before he became a relative. So this can't be the teaching of the Shalcha Mitam either, because we still don't understand why it would then say that this is a very difficult halacha to understand. There's a difficulty with it. There's no difficulty with it. The Gemara now says, Ella, rather, le'olam k'damrinan me'ikara. Really, the teaching of Shalcha Mitam is as we originally understood. That is the first suggestion, not the very first original language of the teaching, but the first proposal how to reconstruct their teaching, that they were referring to a case of a son who attempted to sell his father's properties while his father was still alive, and the son presumed, okay, I'm going to inherit it, so I'll sell it now, I need the cash. The son then died before the father. So the Chachamim sent from Eretz Yisrael that the halacha is the grandson, Chanoch, you know, once the grandfather dies, is simply keep those properties. He inherits the properties, and the purchasers get nothing. And it was suggested that they said about this halacha that this is hard to understand. For why can't the purchasers argue, Avuch Mazvin Vad Mapik, your father sold these properties, and you're simply keeping them, and we end up with nothing. How is that fair? Now, the Gemara had responded that, what do you mean? That's not a problem. That's not a question on this ruling. Because the Pasuk says, Tachas Avosecha Yubonecha, which teaches the halachic principle that grandsons are in the place of sons. And therefore, Chanoch can simply respond to the purchasers, and I'm sorry my father made you that promise, but what does my right to the property have to do with my father? I'm inheriting this property directly from my grandfather. So because of this, the Gemara originally said this can't be what the Shalcha Mitam ruling was. Because then, you know, what's this statement that it's so hard to understand? It's not hard to understand why the purchasers get nothing. But now the Gemara revisits and says, really, it is hard to understand. With the Kakash Shalach, as far as your question and response to what do you mean, what's the big deal? Of course, the purchasers get nothing because, again, The grandson responds with this pasuk, Tehillim tachas avasecha yubanecha, that says that the grandson is in place of the son, and so he directly gets from the grandfather. He skips over the father, and therefore the purchasers get nothing. It was a meaningless sale. The Gemara now says, the pasuk is not saying that. The pasuk is not teaching a halachic principle about the laws of inheritance, that a son's son is in the place of a son in terms of how the inheritance works. Rather, Ahuba bracha ksiv, the pasuk is simply relating a bracha that will fall upon the righteous, that they will have inheritors, Tosa says, who will be righteous like them. That's all it is. It's a bracha. It's not telling us a halachic principle that the grandson is in place of the son. And so the presumption is, the way it really works is, that Reuven bekev, Reuven in the grave, inherits his father Yaakov, and then the inheritance passes from Reuven to his son Chanoch. So now the purchasers say, it's not fair. Your father shouldn't simply bequeath the inheritance to you. No, he sold it to us. So at the very least, we should get compensation. So with this, the Gemara says we can restore the original proposal of above. But the Gemara says, how could you suggest this, that the pasuk in Tehillim tachas avasecha yubanecha is merely pronouncing a blessing for the righteous, that they'll have descendants, turning to Amid Beis, aval inyan dina lo? But you're telling me that the pasuk does not discuss any legal principle of b'nei banim kebanim, that a grandson is legally considered like a son. Ay v'hatanya, I be learned in the Mishnah on Kufnan Zayin Amid Aleph. We learned the Mishnah about the case of Nafal Abayis, Alav Alaviv, Alav Amarishav. The house fell on, let's say, a father and a son, or on a person and somebody he stood to inherit. So meaning some other relationship where you had one person who was the closest of kin to this other person, the house fell on them, and we don't know who died first. Let's say in the case of the father and the son owed some money. Either we could discuss the debt of the ksuba that is owed to the wife upon the husband's death, or balchov is some other creditor who this son owed money to. And the son had no money of his own. The only hope for the creditor to get anything is if the father died first, and that means the son inherited the father for even a moment, and then the creditor's lien would be applied to that property to be able to recoup for the debt. But of course, we don't know what happened here, so there is a dispute in court with the Yorshei Ha'av Omrim Ben Meis Rishon V'Yachagach Meis Ha'av. The father's closest of kin claim that the son died first, and so the creditors cannot claim anything from the father's estate. It never passed through the debtor's, the son's hands. Whereas Ubalchov Omer, the creditor, claims on the other hand that Av Meis Rishon V'Yachagach Meis Ben. Of course, he wants to say that no, the father died first, and therefore temporarily the son did have some property, inherited that property from the father, and then died. But the fact is, he had that property, so we have a lien on the property, so we can take from the property to satisfy the debt. So the Mishnah discussed, and what the halacha is, the Mishnah brought a dispute, Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel, about what the practical halacha is. But the point for us is that clearly the Mishnah is saying that, you know, everybody agrees in this whole dispute that if the son died first, then the son's creditors have zero claim to the father's estate. Now the Gemara says, my love, is it not referring to, could seemingly refer to the following example, that Yorshei Ha'av Bini. Who are these people exactly who are, you know, the family of the father, who are the inheritors of the father, and therefore, you know, they're claiming that the son died first, so we get everything. The Gemara suggests that presumably the Mishnah is referring to sons of this Reuven, the son who died, his own son, so grandsons of Yaakov, the other person who died in the house. Yaakov's grandsons are claiming that our father Reuven died first, and therefore the creditors have no claim because the debtor, our father, never came into possession of the property. And the Gemara says, Morish Avachi. The other example in the Mishnah of, it just says a person and somebody who he stood to inherit from, or literally who would bequeath to him. What's that case? Okay, that case could be referring to where in the house it was Reuven and his brother Shimon, and Shimon had no children of his own, and therefore Shimon in that case would be Reuven's morish, that is, upon Shimon's death, if Shimon predeceases Reuven, then Reuven would inherit Shimon. So if this is the case of the Mishnah, The Gemara now points out, "V'isak daitach lo matzi amar mikach avud abba kasina." If your suggestion is true that we don't say that a grandson, in a situation where we have, let's say in our example, Reuven died before Yaakov, and then Yaakov died. If it's true that Chanoch cannot claim that he's inheriting directly from his grandfather Yaakov, the chiksiv tachas avasach ibenach abibrachiksiv, because we're now suggesting that that pasuk in Tehillim is not teaching that Chanoch is in place of Reuven and directly inherits from Yaakov. Rather, it's just telling us that the righteous receive a bracha of descendants. Then we have a big problem in understanding our Mishnah. Because if that's true, ki meis ha-ben v'yachar kach meis ha-av, even if what really happened here was that Reuven, the debtor, this guy owed money, died before his father, that's the whole claim of the grandsons. My havi, so what if Reuven died first? The creditors should still be able to say to these grandsons that regardless we get to collect from this estate to pay our debt. Because even if Reuven died first, what happens is when Yaakov dies, the inheritance first goes to Reuven. It's a two-step process we're now suggesting. That Reuven inherits the inheritance in the grave and then it passes to his son Chanoch. So the creditors can say, the fact is that no matter what happened here, the inheritance passed through Reuven. And Reuven owes us money, therefore we get to collect this money from the estate. So the Gemara says this seems to prove that our original theory is correct, that really the way it works is it's not a two-step process, rather, if Reuven died, and then Yaakov dies, Chanoch inherits directly from his grandfather Yaakov, because b'nei banim kibanim, that's what we do learn from Tehillim. And so this whole proposal doesn't seem to work, but the Gemara responds, lo, the case is not like you assume, in terms of who these relatives of the father are exactly. You wanted to say that we're talking about the grandsons who are trying to claim that the creditors are not owed money because their father, you know, the son in the house was with his father, died first. We're actually not talking about grandsons making this claim. Rather, Yoshia Av Echav, inheritors of the father that our Mishnah refers to, are the brothers of the son who died with his father in the house. So Reuven's brothers, Shimon and Levi, they're the ones who are saying that we claim the entire estate of our father. The creditors get nothing because our brother Reuven died before our father. In which case, obviously, Shimon and Levi, these other brothers, inherit the property directly from their father Yaakov. It doesn't go through Reuven. They inherit directly from Yaakov. So indeed, the creditors then would have a zero claim. And if we say that the first case mentioned in our Mishnah of the Yosheav is talking about the brothers of the son that died in the house, well, then we have to adjust the other case in the Mishnah. We can no longer say as above that that case is talking about where it was Reuven and his brother, because Mishnah already mentioned brother with the phrase Yosheav. So the Gemara says, okay, we can say Morisha of Achi Devua. Second case of the Mishnah of a person and somebody who is bequeathing to him who died in the house, we could say that's referring to where it was Reuven and his uncle Esav, let's say, was in the house together with Reuven. And it fell on them. We don't know who died first. Meaning the case is that Reuven's father Yaakov is no longer alive. And Uncle Esav has no children. So in that situation, his nephew Reuven would inherit him. So that's the other case of the Mishnah, where again, there would be a question about, you know, depending on who died first, to determine whether Reuven's creditor could recoup anything from the next of kin to Uncle Esav. But the point is that the Gemara upholds the assertion that a grandson, when his father had died before his grandfather, does not claim that inheritance directly from the grandfather, but rather it is a two-step process. First, the inheritance passes to the father who's in the grave, and then the father bequeaths it to the grandson. As such, it was fairly stated that Zui Kasha B'dinei Mamonos, the halacha that we're saying that the purchasers end up with nothing, is hard to understand. Because seemingly, since that inheritance passes through the father, Reuven, who did agree with the purchasers, you know, he sold it to them and he guaranteed the sale. So it's hard to understand why Chanoch simply claims the inheritance and doesn't have to pay the purchasers a dime. The Rishbam says, although we have this difficulty with the ruling, nonetheless, this is the halacha. And the purchasers in this case get zero. Having mentioned this concept that when the next of kin happens to be dead, the halacha can still say that the inheritance goes to that dead next of kin and then to his next of kin, The Gemara wonders whether this would apply in a different case. Bo mine mirav sheshes. They asked Rav Sheshes, Ben mahu sheyirashes imo bekever lahanchilachin mina av. What is the halacha as to whether son inherits his mother in the grave? So the case is the son died before his mother. The question is, when the mother then dies, does that inheritance still go to the son in the grave? If you say it does, the practical consequence would be that if this deceased son had paternal stepbrothers, they would then claim this inheritance. Whereas if you say the dead son does not inherit the inheritance of his mother in the grave, then the mother's closest paternal relatives would take the inheritance. Amalur of Sheshes responded to them, Tanisua, the answer to your question is found in the following brisa, which teaches, if Ha'av Shenishba, if a father was taken into captivity and died while in captivity, Umez Benob Medina. Meanwhile, his son at home also died. We don't know who died first, or vice versa, Ben Shenishba Umez of Medina. Maybe the son was captured and died in captivity, and the father died here at home. Again, we don't know who died first. And that, of course, impacts the question of who takes the father's inheritance. The halacha is, Yorshe ha'av, Yorshe ha'ben yachloku. The vying inheritors of the father, inheritors of the son, would split the disputed inheritance. So, Sheshes first analyzes the braisa. Echidami, what exactly is the case of this braisa? Ilei makidiktani, if we interpret this braisa literally, as stated, that we're literally talking about a father and a son. A regular case of a father and a son, we don't know who died first. And the problem is the case doesn't make sense. So what does it mean you have competing claims between the father's inheritors and the son's inheritors? Hai ninu yarshe av, hai ninu yarshe ben. The same people who inherit the father inherit the son. They would both be the closest paternal relatives of these two people. So you simply don't have a case of two different groups of relatives. It's one group of relatives. So you couldn't have such a case. Elalav hachi kamar. This must be, the braisa really means to refer to the following case. Av shenishba, a father was captured and died in captivity, umeis ben bito b'medina, and his grandson, specifically the son of his daughter, died here at home. We don't know who died first, or vice versa, ben bito shenishba umeis avim b'medina. Maybe the grandson died in captivity, and his grandfather, again his mother's father, died here at home. We don't know who died first. So now we have a case. Now there are two different groups of relatives who are fighting over the inheritance. That is, we have Yorshe Ha'av, the inheritors of the father on the one hand, and Yorshe Ha'ben, the inheritors of the son. That is, this son through the grandfather's daughter, his paternal stepbrothers, who the point is have no paternal relationship, no inheritance type of relationship to this grandfather. So now you have the case, they're fighting who died first. Of course, the grandson's relatives want to say that the grandfather died first, and so the grandson inherited him, and so we get this inheritance now, whereas the grandfather's relatives say, not true, the grandson died first, therefore we get everything. The Raisa rules in this case that the halacha is yachloku. They split the disputed property. So Sheshes now explains his proof from the Braisa, which is v'im isa, if it were true that a son inherits his mother even if he's in the grave, even if he dies before his mother, the inheritance still passes through that son, and this whole Braisa doesn't make sense. For nihi nami de ben meis bereisha, even if it were true that the grandson here died first, lirse le'avua di'ime b'kivre sawat, the grandson would still inherit the grandfather through his mother in the grave, and then vilir sinhu lachua min avua, an inheritance still passes to his, the grandson's stepbrothers through his father, the inheritance would then pass to them. And so regardless of who died first over here, the stepbrothers of the grandson should win the case, they should outright win the whole estate. So if Sheshes says, Elo lav shmamina, so must be, we learn from here, that ein haben yorish is imo bakever lahanchalachin me'av. Apparently, then, we see from the Braisa, one does not inherit from his mother once already in the grave. Okay, then, very good. Now we understand the dispute. The grandfather's relatives claim that the grandson died first. The inheritance does not go to him at all. And so they're saying the inheritance goes to them. Of course, we don't know what happened here, so the halacha is he split it. And the Gemara brings another proof, this time from our Mishnah. Omer of Acha b'min Yumi l'Abai. Acha b'min Yumi said to Abai, Afa na nami tanina. We also have a proof to answer this question from our Mishnah. Our Mishnah taught us, if nafal abayis, alav v'al imo. Let's say a person and his mother were in a house, and the house collapsed, killing them both. We don't know who died first. And now the inheritors of each person fight about who died first, and therefore gets to claim the mother's inheritance. The Mishnah said that elu ve'elu modin shiachloku. Everybody agrees in this case that the halacha is, the party is split, the property of the mother's estate that's under dispute. So Vacha Rabbi Yumi points out that v'im isa, if it's true that a son inherits his mother even once in the grave, the Mishnah doesn't seem to make sense. For nehi nami the ben meis bereisha, even if the son really died first, lir seili maybe kivrei, so what? Shouldn't change the fact. You're saying the halacha is, even if he dies first, he inherits her in the grave, and consequently, the sons then inherit that deceased son, their brother. And so no matter what happened here, the brothers of the deceased son should win the case, not the mother's paternal relatives. So what do we see? Elav shmamina. Again, we see that's not the way it works. When it comes to inheriting the mother, a son does not inherit his mother while in the grave. Shma mina, indeed, we learn this from the Mishnah. It's a clear proof from the Mishnah. The Gemara now explains v'taimamai. Why is it that when it comes to inheriting this specific relative, we don't say that the son inherits his mother while in the grave? That is the halacha in general by other relatives. So why is it different here? Amar Abayi explains, Nemra Siba v'ben, v'nemra Siba v'bal. The Torah uses a language of Siva, goes around, circulates, it transfers, when it talks about inheritance in the context of a son, and in the context of a husband who inherits his wife. So this similar language tells us to compare the halachas of one to the other in the following way. Just as when it comes to a husband inheriting his wife, the halacha is, we don't say that the right of the husband to inherit his wife works even once she is in the grave. That is, let's say a man was married to a woman who died, and then inheritance fell to that woman. Her father, let's say, died. The halacha is, we don't say that the husband inherits his wife when she's already in the kever, in the grave. So similarly, it's not exactly parallel, but it's, you know, working with a similar principle. Av siva mura b'ben. So too, when it comes to a son, there's also halacha where the Yerusha doesn't go in the grave by a son, namely, Eina ben Yerush is imo b'kever. A son will not inherit his mother, like just like husband to the wife, so son to the mother, it doesn't work even while in the grave, meaning, if the son has died already, he does not inherit his mother in the grave, lahanchil achim min av, to then pass the inheritance to his, let's say, step paternal brothers. Rather, her inheritance would fall to her closest paternal relatives. Now, the past few Mishnayos worked with the principle of muchzik. That is, sometimes when there is a monetary dispute, we rule based on the principle that whoever has physical possession of the property in question, halacha will presume that he is the owner and he will win the case unless the other party can bring proof otherwise. So in connection with this principle, the Gemara brings two cases that we actually studied already back in Cheskas Abadim. This will be a little bit of review for us. The Gemara first relates the following case. Sahudi Amrlei Lechavrei, somebody once said to his friend, and as two people made an agreement, and the seller said to the buyer, Nichsi de bar sisin mizavnina lach. I hereby agree to sell you all of the properties that I purchased from a fellow named Bar Sisin. Now, havai chad ara de havi mekarya de bay Bar Sisin. There was one particular piece of land that was actually called the estate of Bar Sisin. So certainly the simple understanding of that title is that this property once belonged to Bar Sisin, and therefore it should be included in the sale. However, when it came down to the buyer actually taking this property, he said, okay, I'm going to take that property too. Obviously, you got that from Bar Sisin. Amrlei, the seller said to the buyer, no, just one minute. You're not taking that property. For in reality, ho lav de bay Bar Sisin he. I did not purchase that particular property from Bar Sisin. Mikruya hu de makarya de bay Bar Sisin. It so happens that it's called the estate of Bar Sisin, but I didn't purchase it from him, and so it's not part of our agreement. It's not included in the sale. Mar says, also, l'kameid Rav Nachman, the case came before Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman was ukma biyada de lokeach. Nachman ruled in favor of the buyer. And so he awarded the property to the buyer. Amalei Rav, or Rav Nachman, Rav objected to Rav Nachman, dina hachi. Is this the right halacha here? He says, no. We apply the principle that the one who's trying to take away property from somebody else, meaning the buyer ultimately, is trying to seize this land from the seller. The seller has possession right now. So we should apply the rule that says the burden of proof is on the one who's trying to take away the property. So Rava rules in favor of the seller. Seller, if he says, no, I didn't buy this one from Bar Sisin, that it's upon the buyer to prove otherwise. The Gemara points out, though, that Virami, the Rava, the Rav Nachman, the Rav Nachman. Both Rava and Rav Nachman appear to contradict themselves on their respective views as to who should win in this kind of a case. Once upon a time, there was a fellow who called Reuven, who came over to his friend Shimon, who was occupying a certain property. He said, "Hey Shimon, my bias, my besa, hey, what are you doing in my house? This is my house. It's time for you to go." Amrlei, Shimon responds, "Why? Minach zevinta v'achlis shnei chazaka. I bought this house from you. And even though I don't have a deed of sale that can prove that, however, the evidence is still on my side that I legitimately purchased this from you, for I've been here for 3 years, living in this house, and you said nothing the whole time." And so with this, Shimon wants to claim a chazaka. Of course, the principle we studied in Cheskas Abatim that says that indeed, if the occupant was there, was on the property for 3 years or more, and the previously known owner did not protest at all, then we don't have a question on the occupant anymore that, hey, why didn't you still have the deed of sale? He could say, "Listen, I can't hold on to it forever. I lost it. I didn't feel any urgency to hold on to it since nobody ever questioned my legitimate ownership of this property." So this is Shimon's defense. Now Reuven, who is known to have been the previous owner, Amrlei, responds to Shimon that your occupancy in this case doesn't count as chazaka, for ana b'shchuni gavoy avoy, because I was living there too. I was in an inner chamber, and you know full well, Shimon, that we were living there together. We were roommates. And yes, I put up with you this whole time, but it was understood between us that it's my place, and I was letting you stay here. So you can't draw any conclusions from the fact that I didn't say anything. This was an understood arrangement between us, and now it's time for you to go. And also the kameid of Nachman. The case came before of Nachman, who ruled Amrlei zil baror chilasach. Of Nachman told Shimon, the new occupant, the person claiming that I became the owner, he said, "You got a problem, Shimon. You indeed have to verify your claim. We need more evidence that you legitimately made a chazaka here if you want to claim this property." And so Rav Nachman was ruling in favor of the original owner. Amalei Rav, Rav Nachman. Rav objected to Rav Nachman's ruling. Dina hachi, is this the halacha? No, the halacha here says that ha-motzi mechavera lavaraya, the burden of proof is upon the one who's trying to take away from the other one, who in this case is Reuven. Because right now, Shimon is actually occupying the property, and nobody told us, there's no indication, as far as we can tell, that Reuven was there too. And Reuven's saying he was there, but there's no evidence, there's no like rumors going around to support that. And therefore Shimon, the new occupant, the one who's saying, "I became the owner," wins. So the Gemara points out that first of all, Kasha, the Rava appears to contradict himself. For the case of Bar Sisin, Rava ruled in favor of the previous owner, meaning the seller in that case, who says, "No, this one was not from Bar Sisin." Rava said, "We rule like the previous owner, against the new owner." Whereas in this case, he says the opposite. Rava rules in favor of the new owner, this Shimon who's claiming that he became the owner of this house. And the Gemara says, "The Rav Nachman, the Rav Nachman." Rav Nachman also appears to contradict himself. For previously in the Bar Sisin case, Rav Nachman ruled in Shimon's favor, the buyer's favor, the person who's saying, "I became the owner of this land." Whereas in the present case, Rav Nachman rules in favor of the previous owner, Reuven, and he says, Reuven can say to Shimon, "Prove that you made a proper chazak of the property. Until then, Reuven will be the presumed owner." But the Gemara answers that in fact there's no contradiction here. First of all, the Rava lokasha. Rava does not contradict himself. For the answer is, Rava consistently applies the rule of a motzi mechavera levaraya. We look at who is the one who's in current possession. It's not about who's the previous owner, who's the new owner. We have to look at who has the physical possession of the property under dispute. And so, Hacha Mocher Kai Benechse. In case number one, by Bar Sisin, the seller still retains physical possession of the property. And so he says to the buyer, "You say that this field is included in the sale, you got to prove it." There, in the case of the house, the fact is that who is now in physical possession, who's physically occupying the house? It's Shimon. So Shimon has the upper hand. Shimon is the one who says, look, by all indications, I made a valid chazakah. I occupied this place. You didn't protest the whole time. And nobody heard about this claim that you're saying that you were here also the whole time. So Rava applies, Motzi Mechaver L'Avarai again. He says, Shimon says to Reuven, you're the burden of proof. If you want to say you were here too, then the burden of proof is upon you to prove that. So Rava does not contradict himself. And the Gemara says, the Rav Nachman, other Rav Nachman Lokasha. There's also no contradiction as far as Rav Nachman's view. For the answer is, Hacha, here in case number one, in the Bar Sisin case, here's what Rav Nachman is saying. Kivin, the Amr Leh, the Bei Bar Sisin, says, look, what does the evidence suggest? They made an agreement that all lands purchased from Bar Sisin, now Reuven is selling that to Shimon. Umekarya, the Bei Bar Sisin, and this land is called Estate of Bar Sisin. So the overwhelming evidence suggests that this land came from Bar Sisin. And therefore, notwithstanding the fact that, yes, Reuven has physical possession, but like, come on, there's overwhelming evidence here that suggests that this land was included in the sale agreement. So, Lady De Rami Ligaluye, the Lav De Bay Bar Sisin, he is therefore incumbent upon Reuven. It's upon the seller to prove otherwise. If he wants to come up and say that, no, really, it was just happened to be called the estate of Bar Sisin, but I didn't buy this one from him, well, then, Reuven, you got to prove that. And if you can't, Shimon's going to be able to keep that land. Whereas, let's talk about the case of the house. So Shimon's staying in the house. He says, I was here for 3 years, Reuven, and you said nothing. In this case, Rav Nachman says as follows. In the final analysis, what is Shimon's basis to claim this house? He is claiming the house based on chazakah. What does chazakah mean? As we explained, it means that it's an excuse, essentially, for not having the deed of sale to prove that if it's really true you bought the house, where's the deed of sale? So he says, well, I was here for 3 years and nobody protested, so that should essentially be in lieu of producing an actual deed of sale. But surely, whatever power chazakah gives Shimon, it can't be better than an actual deed of sale. And so Rav Nachman makes the following argument. Hacha lo yehe'ela dinakit shtara. Even if we fully grant Shimon the power of chazakah, that's not going to be greater than evidence of an actual document. Now, in the case of an actual document, Milo Amrinan Le Kayim Shtarach Vekum Benichzi, is it not standard procedure to require somebody who produces a document that he wants to use to take away money to first verify the document? Certainly, that is standard procedure. And so Rav Nachman says, when Reuven responds to Shimon that it's very nice chazakah, but I have a question on your chazakah. There is a flaw in your chazakah, for I say I was there too. By Reuven raising that question with the chazakah, that forces Shimon to verify the chazakah. We're not saying he doesn't have a chazakah. He does. He was here for 3 years and nobody said anything. But now that this question was raised, that maybe Reuven, who we do know was the previous owner, was there also the whole time, you, Shimon, are going to have to refute his claim. You're going to have to prove that it's not true. Now let's see, you know, if witnesses testify that Reuven was living somewhere else, and then fine, then you'll be able to use your chazak as if it was a shtar and maintain, you know, be the established owner of the house. But until then, you have to first discredit this question that Reuven is raising with your chazakah. This then concludes Perek Mishameis, Hadron Allah Perek Mishameis.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shiur. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD1. That's 855-275-7231.